Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Danny Werfel, Controller, Office of Federal Financial Management within OMB. Danny, I'd like to talk a little bit about the administration's efforts to get legislative authority to reform and consolidate the federal government. Would you tell us more about this effort? What are some of the benefits of doing such a thing, and what are some of the challenges?
I'm glad you asked. I think the president was very clear and has been clear, and I mentioned it earlier, his interest in a government for the 21st century. And I think it was in a State of the Union address where he detailed, I think, in very effectively, some of the oddities that have emerged over time, that if you're not dynamic in the way in which you are realigning the organizations of government to meet emerging missions, it's kind of this fundamental question of whether you design your objectives and your goals around what your organizations of government are set up to do, or alternatively, do you pick the right objectives and goals and then align your organizations to most effectively meet those goals? And I think the president believes that the latter is the right approach to better government. In order to do that, in order to breathe life into that, to make sure that our agencies are structured in a way to meet 21st century realities and priorities, you need a mechanism by which to more fluidly realign and reorganize government. And right now, we don't have an effective mechanism in place. You know, for 50 years, from the 1930s to the 1980s, there was this authority that the president had to initiate proposals to reorganize government. And Congress could get the proposal, and it would be done on a fast-track basis. There'd be kind of like an up or down vote, because you can imagine some of the challenges, the competing stakeholder interest challenges that would emerge as you try to bring different parts of government together or eliminate a part of government. It has all kinds of complicating elements when you try to make that type of transformation. So the reorg authority is usually built in certain parameters that help get through that, such as fast-track congressional procedures, up or down vote by Congress, rather than everyone kind of peace-parting and negotiating every single detail. So what the president asked for is authority that is similar, but we think improved, to the authority that existed for 50 years, from the 1930s to the 1980s, where the president would be able to submit for up or down vote proposals to reorganize government. We made some enhancements that we think are important. For example, and I'll just mention the most critical. Under our proposal for reorganization, we can only submit proposals that save money, that actually lead to efficiency. So the legislation that existed for 50 years that terminated in the 1980s, you could reorganize government and grow the size of government, not under our proposal. And so to make sure that this is being done out of a desire to limit the complexity of government, to streamline government and to make it more user-friendly and to have it reflect, again, 21st century realities, technology, the way in which services and benefits are delivered. And in submitting that proposal, the president signaled the first terrain that he wanted to take on, which is trade and competitiveness. So we looked at all the different, there's six different agencies, Commerce, SBA, and I can go on, that are involved, EXIM and the U.S. Trade Representative and others that are involved in this terrain. And we talked to and met with so many different stakeholders, owners of small businesses and large businesses, members of Congress, all sorts of individuals that have to do business with the government in this terrain, and have articulated back to us how complex the bureaucracy can be when you have overlapping and redundant organizations working on similar issues. And so the concept behind this proposal would be, the reorg authority is a framework by which the president can submit various proposals. And we gave Congress and the American people a sense of what a proposal could look like, which is to streamline our various agencies that are involved in trade and competitiveness. The trade and competitiveness proposal alone would save $3 billion over 10 years, but would also bring together a variety of different critical resources. And how important is it today to have an effective set of programs programs around job growth, economic growth, trade, and competitiveness. It's as important as it could ever be, because we wanted to demonstrate that there's really some there. There's really some opportunities that exist, and we're not going to stop with trade and competitiveness. We're gonna look at other areas as well, and we're actively looking at them now. But the bottom line here is that if you want a government that's going to be dynamic to meet emerging challenges, and we have many emerging challenges, then you need a flexibility that needs to be in place to reorganize government in ways that reflect what's going on in the 21st century. Our challenges, the technology that's available, geography, whatever, things are constantly changing. And the notion that we would have the same government structures that have been in place for decades or centuries really doesn't make sense at its base. And that's what the president is trying to fix.
Switching gears here, let's talk a little bit about the government-wide financial statements and the audit of those statements. I know most agencies now have clean, unqualified opinions, but we still don't have it yet on the government-wide financial statements. Can you talk a little bit about the impediments to getting a clean opinion and a schedule for ultimately getting there?
Sure, Steve. I think the first point I would want to make is that I'm extremely proud to be a part of the financial management community for the accomplishments they've made in this particular area and in many other areas. But you know, you start back in 1990 with no CFOs and no financial statements, and we sit here today. Just about every agency has a clean opinion, or at least an opinion, or at least a qualified opinion. We only have one agency that still does not get an opinion on their financial statements, and that's the Defense Department. And we're reporting in time frames that are much quicker than we ever imagined. You know, for over a decade, these financial statements were coming in 6 months or later after the fiscal year, and now they come in 45 days after the fiscal year. The number of weaknesses that are found in these financial statements, not only are we getting clean opinions, but each of these opinions have findings of where the auditors are raising concerns, and those are steeply declining over time. So we are hitting a rhythm and getting to a stable kind of performance environment where it's almost we almost take it for granted at this point, where virtually every agency is going to have a clean opinion or at least a qualified opinion. And one of the main reasons why we don't have a clean opinion at the consolidated level is the Defense Department. They're really kind of the last domino to fall. The challenge is that that's a very large and complex domino. You know, I mentioned earlier that I've tried to be a student of my surroundings and my challenges, and I've tried to become a student of the Defense Department and the various issues associated with its efforts to get a clean opinion. I still have a lot of learning to do. It's the largest and most complex organization in the world. It has grown up in an environment over many, many decades of having different approaches to its procedures, to its account structures, to the way in which it makes transactions and captures information on those transactions. The systems don't integrate or are not interoperable with one another. In order to modernize those systems, it's expensive, it's complex. They are geographically dispersed, they're internationally dispersed, they have domestic and international presence. And the cleanup that needs to be done in that organization is exponentially more challenging than every other organization in government. That's not to make excuses, because they need to do it. They need to get the job done, and they have made progress. But there is still a lot to be done in this area. And the fact that they are the, you know, half our balance sheet in terms of assets, for as an example, and just the sheer size, it's not going to be possible for us to get a clean opinion on the consolidated until we get to a better place on the Defense Department. I think Secretary Panetta has been clear in terms of asking the Defense Department to accelerate their timeframes for getting hitting some key milestones on their audit. So I think the leadership is engaged. I think they're dedicated to doing the job, and there's a lot of work that's churning to get it done. But it is simply, it's just not an overnight thing. And in particular, the system changes that are necessary to automate some of their and standardize some of their business processes in order to make this happen is not an overnight proposition.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of having Bob Hale on the show, and he outlined some of the challenges. But a good strategy for getting it done, even the accelerated time frame to 2014. But Danny, you mentioned accomplishments when we talked about the audit ability. This year marks the 22nd anniversary, as I understand, of the CFO Act of 1990. As you reflect on the federal financial management community's progress over the last 20 plus years. What are some of those key accomplishments you want to talk about?
Well, there's many. I mean, I know obviously there's we still have a long way to go to meet all of our financial management goals, and I don't know that you ever get there because you constantly shift your risk profile to make sure that you are in a zone in an area of continuous improvement. But let me start, if I could, with some specifics and then make a general point. On improper payments, as an example, which we've spoken a lot about on the show today, we are at a place right now where just about every major program is seeing error rate declines every year. So there are over $100 billion in improper payments each year, and that is a staggering number that we need to do better on. The issue is we are doing better on it. Of several programs, about 10 or so programs, make up most of that 100-plus billion amount. Medicare, Medicaid, SNAP, or what used to be called food stamps, Social Security, public housing, to name a few, the earned income tax credit. These are some of the programs that make up this large amount. In every case, except for one, we are essentially seeing declines in the error rate. The one exception is the unemployment insurance program at the Labor Department. That is the one program where the error rate, if you look at the numbers, has been trending upward over the last several years and not downward. And that's something that we're very concerned about and have a very close working relationship with the Department of Labor to try to crack that nut and figure out how to reverse that trend. You know, it doesn't diminish the fact that all the other programs, Medicare, Medicaid, the HUD program, SNAP, and others are seeing precipitous declines in their error rate, and that's having an impact on the number of improper payments we're making. And I think that is a reflection of these error rate declines, the fact that in these major programs, the improper payments are going down, that the work that we're doing is starting to have an impact. You know, one of the lessons learned in improper payments or in anything is that modest corrective actions and modest strategies are going to lead to modest results. You need to have innovation and you need to push the envelope in order to get changes. And in particular at HHS, they are really, really passionate and I would say almost relentless in their pursuit of driving the error rates down in Medicare, Medicaid. And that is starting to resolve. If you just look at the numbers, those error rates are trending downward. Now, on a government-wide basis, because the error rate is trending downward over the last 2 years, those error rate reductions equate to $20 billion in improper payments avoided. In other words, if the error rate would not have declined the way it did, we would be at an improper payment amount $20 billion higher than we are today. So we're very proud of that. Let me shift gears to real estate and make a key point. You know, in the previous administration, it's an interesting thing to do to compare the executive order on real estate that President Bush issued in 2004 versus the executive order that President Obama issued in 2010. The Bush EO establishes kind of the foundations of real estate management. It put in place a senior real property officer. It required us to the government to develop a worldwide inventory of real estate that didn't exist at the time. It required every agency to put in together plans to improve their capital acquisitions and asset management. And we were off and running, putting in a senior official, creating a networking council of real estate officials, building an inventory. And that's the work. That was the brunt and the basic run of the work under the Bush administration. Now, compare and contrast that with President Obama's executive order, which said very simply, save $3 billion in civilian by the end of 2012 and save $5 billion in military. So save $8 billion. I mean, that was kind of the bottom line. And I mean, that was made in part that kind of directness of just a bottom line expectation and performance target obviously was made possible by the work that was done in the previous years. Mm-hmm. But it's also a growth of the community around now that we've built this foundation, we've got the inventories, we've got the clean audit opinions, we have more stable financial management structures in place. It's time to make sure that we are using that foundation to execute on bottom line results for the taxpayer. It's time to bring that error rate down and do so precipitously. It's time to sell off unused real estate and renegotiate leases and consolidate space and close field offices and do all the things that we can now do because we're managing our real estate more effectively. We're changing assumptions about how we use our real estate by having agencies combine to share warehouses or by rethinking office usage, you know, looking at, you know, how many people would we have in a building in a given day, and do they all need their own offices, or can we do like what the private sector is doing in terms of, you know, having common spaces where people can plug in their computers and not everyone needs a 10 by 10 office. We're still somewhat embryonic in these things, but we're starting to transform our approaches to real estate in a way that's resulting in savings. And the president set a goal of $3 billion by the end of this year. We're updating that information periodically. We just had our most recent update about a week ago. We're at $2.4 billion and counting. So we are on our way. In fact, if we look, and that's on the civilian side, mm-hmm. we are, I think, at north of $3 billion on the military side. So we are way ahead of schedule or on schedule, a certain degree, to hit the $8 billion goal. We like where the numbers are going. And all of that results from the community of managers and leaders that I work with on a daily basis executing on real changes. And those are accomplishments to be proud of. I would say as a general matter, perhaps what I'm most proud of is the place that the CFO has landed after all this time. I mean, when I started my foray into financial management in 2003, I found myself in and Steve might remember some of this because I think you were in some of the think tanks and association meetings that I was in at the time. You know, there was a debate about what is the role of the CFO and, you know, why are they not central to their organization? Is the work relevant enough? Because what the, you know, secretaries and debt secretaries were not finding a lot of, you know, immediate value in the balance sheet and the financial statement audits, because ultimately those are about making sure that the inner workings of the department are running well, but they don't necessarily translate into the bottom line results that it's not apparent. It's once you get those inner workings down and working effectively, it enables you as a launching point to then execute on more mission and bottom line related elements of a government organization. And now where we were in 2009, so using the Recovery Act as an example, I mean, the first major management challenge of this administration was getting those transparency and accountability provisions of the Recovery Act in place. And the CFOs were central to all of that. We wouldn't have had a prayer at being successful in those provisions if we had the 1995 version of the federal financial management community. It was the 2009 version of the federal financial management community that enabled us to be successful in meeting those very challenging transparency and accountability requirements. And it was very clear, and it has been since day one, that the CFOs are going to be the fulcrum and anchor of some very key things. Shoot forward to the June executive order from last year on the campaign to cut waste. It places the CFO of the federal agencies directly in the driver's seat of being responsible to the vice president to meet these mandates. And, you know, I just compare and contrast. In 2003, when I first started, we didn't have this kind of interrelationship between the president and the CFO or the vice president and the CFO with this kind of expectation of delivering on results that are central to critical administration priorities that are being talked about by the president and the vice president directly on a frequent basis that are in the national consciousness. I mean, today, government waste is a national consciousness issue. Today, the transparency of where federal dollars are going makes it onto the Tonight Show and other things. These are front and center issues, and the CFOs are, in many cases, connecting with doubles and triples, and, you know, we're having our setbacks too. Mm-hmm. That's always part of the fabric of what we do. But we have a framework that's in place that when we do have a setback, that we have the ability to understand why that setback occurred and how to fix it both on a agency basis and on a government-wide basis. And over time, I think we're getting better at federal financial management. A lot of work to do, but I'm confident. I think that the road ahead is going to be filled with important accomplishments.
What does the future hold for OMB's Office of Federal Financial Management? We will ask its leader, Danny Warfel, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.